Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher, 8:06 on this Tuesday, June 22nd, 59 degrees here in Old Town Park City. And on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, it's Thomas Gaboy. Good morning.
Good morning to you and good Tuesday morning. And weather-wise, we're looking at a pretty good day in Park City, but the only thing to keep in mind is that it's going to be a windy and warm day, and because of the wind today, there is a red flag warning today, so avoid any outdoor burning, as any fire that starts could quickly grow just because it's going to be windy, and we'll see winds today probably around the magnitude of 15 miles per hour with the occasional gust. That's probably going to be higher than that with winds out of the southwest. Daytime highs today, Park City likely to be in the 80s. Meanwhile, into tonight, looking at a partly cloudy sky, temperatures dropping back to around 60. But then as we move into tomorrow, Park City will be included in a fire weather watch because we're going to be introducing the chance for a few isolated thunderstorms by the time we get to the afternoon. So in the elevated areas like in Park City, if we do find thunderstorms, it's likely going to be on the dry side. Chances are just not enough moisture to really get enough moisture to really have a decent amount of rain. So with thunderstorms being on the dry side, that could lead to lightning, could spark some fires, and also outflow boundaries could also lead to some stronger winds. But the moisture content will continue to increase from Wednesday into Wednesday night. So by Wednesday night, we could start to see maybe a little bit of precipitation reaching the ground. The best chance of actually seeing rain is probably going to be on Thursday. So as we go from high temperatures today, around 80, it'll be middle 70s tomorrow, then likely to be around 70 degrees on Thursday with that higher rain chance. And keeping a small chance maybe for a few isolated thunderstorms into Friday as high temperatures will be in the lower 70s. But as we move into the upcoming weekend, we're back to an abundantly sunny sky. Temperatures in the mornings likely to be in the middle to upper 50s. Daytime highs in the middle to upper 70s Saturday and Sunday, and then likely back into the lower 80s by next Monday.
Okay, thanks, Thomas.
You're welcome.
808 here on KPCW. Stay tuned. Coming up, we've got a conversation with Summit County Development Director Pat Putt talking about potential water restrictions in Summit County. Then the regional manager of the Utah chapter of the Alzheimer's Association, Amanda Charles, along with Summit County residents Charles, Glenn and Tracy Seymour, with details on today's Alzheimer's caregiver panel. Finally, author Libby Ludlow and illustrator Nathan Jarvis with details about the launching of their Kickstarter campaign for their new book, Goodnight Chairlift. Well, a Heber City native and BYU track star is having a busy month competing in the NCAA National Championships and Olympic Trials. KPCW's Ben Lassiter has more on his path to the Olympic Games, which has been even more competitive than normal this year.
Talem Franco grew up in Heber City and graduated from Wasatch High School in 2013. After serving an LDS mission, he went to BYU to run the 1500-meter race and is at the end of his final season there now as a grad student. And he's going out with a bang, to put it mildly. Last week, he placed 9th in the National Track and Field Championships in Eugene, Oregon. Next week, he has a shot at the Olympic Games, which he earned by posting one of the fastest times of any American in the past 2 years. The 1500 meter is just under a mile in distance, and he came in at 3 minutes and 37 seconds a couple of months ago.
This is my very first Olympic trials, so it's kind of cool that I'm able to compete my senior year, supposedly in the best shape of my life. It's really cool to think that like the accumulation of all my work can kind of show, hopefully this next week, as I compete in this tournament play.
At the trials, former track medalists and rising stars like Allison Phoenix and Trayvon Brummel will also compete for Olympic spots. Only 30 runners make it to the trials in Franco's event, and this was a particularly competitive year. In past years, runners qualified by submitting their best times from the year leading to the trials. This year, because the games in Tokyo were rescheduled from last summer, runners could submit times from all the way back to 2019. Making the field more crowded.
I'm pretty ecstatic to the fact that I got selected because it's a very cutthroat system, the track and field. You really have to run fast in order to show that you're meant to be there. And I'm glad that I ran fast enough that shows that I'm meant to be there. And I hope to prove that too.
At the national championships race in Eugene, Oregon, Franco came in 9th. He feels he is capable of an even better performance than his race there, and he has posted better times recently, including one that was 3 seconds faster. Though his body may want a bit more recovery time after running in 4 races last week, the biggest races of his life are just a week away.
So it's a very long tournament play, so you need a lot of tactical strength plus a lot of resilience, because it's pretty much a war of attrition. As any senior would envision them winning their last race and being able to be deem themselves a national champion, I wasn't able to do that. So with all the circumstances and everything like that, it was a super fast year, like I said. So the fact that I was able to make it at such a high level and compete against all these high caliber athletes was an immense blessing. And I'm hoping to kind of take that and learn from my mistakes and hopefully perform better at the trials.
Of the 30 American runners competing in the 1500, only three will make the Olympic team.
I'm really looking forward to it. The fact that I am there means that I have a shot, and that's really cool.
In other events, 11 of Franco's teammates are competing in Olympic trials too. 8 BYU men and 4 women in total have chances to represent Utah on the world stage in other track races, pole vault, steeplechase, and javelin. Franco completed his undergraduate degree in microbiology in April of 2020 and is interviewing to go to med school. The first of his qualifying rounds will take place next Thursday back in Eugene, Oregon. The semifinal and final races will be held on Friday and Sunday. Ben Lassiter, KPCW News.
Well, due to the drought, Summit County is considering putting water restrictions into place. On the phone with details is Summit County Community Development Director Pat Putt. Good morning, Pat.
Good morning, Wesley. Can you hear me?
Yep. So this is the first I've heard of this. What's being discussed?
Well, what we're building towards here, hopefully in the real near future, is an initial sit down with the Summit County Council to talk about what strategies could be put in place to help better address our drought conditions. Last week, I had an opportunity to sit in on an interdepartmental interagency discussion, and involved in that were community development, the health department, our sustainability team with Emily, and Scott Morrison from Mountain Regional Water. What we'd like to do is to schedule an opportunity to get in front of council to take a look at what steps might be considered in order, as I say, to help better address this. As of right now, we don't have a date scheduled. We're hoping to get in front of the council as soon as we can, hopefully in early July. So there isn't a date. There's no draft ordinance. There's no temporary zoning ordinance right now being drafted in the wings. What we first want to do is begin the discussion with the council to help them better understand the situation we're in, what tools might be available, and then hopefully a follow-up step would be some outreach and some education. And when I say that, I mean, obviously everybody's aware of the drought, but we'd like to get the key stakeholders involved. Those would be folks like the water companies. These would be hopefully representatives from the homeowners associations in the area, which I think are going to need to have a real critical seat in this discussion, as well as the general public. What could come out of that? It may be some more robust restrictions. It likely will be some direction to the planning staff to take a look at what our existing development code criteria and regulations for things like landscaping and watering are. They were recently updated probably about a half dozen years ago, but they could stand to have a deeper dive and a more in-depth look at what those regulations are. And so before we drop any new rules or regulations or restrictions, we want to have a bigger community discussion on that.
Let's take a step back. What is the situation we're in? We know we are in a drought, but I mean, are water sources, are they precarious at this point? I mean, what is the situation?
Yeah, I wouldn't want to speculate on that from my perspective, Leslie. I would think that representatives from the individual districts and water delivery companies are probably better equipped to answer that question. My educated guess is, yeah, resources are strained and will become more constrained as we move forward. I think the key opportunity here is to get out in front of this as fast as we can. Some may say, well, we should have been out in front of this sooner, you know, perhaps. But I think where we have to be able to get ourselves is we're not sure how long this current climatic condition is going to exist. We don't know if we're in the beginning or the middle of this drought cycle that we're in. if we're somewhere in the middle of this, or if we're in the beginning of this, the time now isn't to discuss why we weren't doing something. I think the time needs to be spent on what we can do collectively as a community to start addressing it now. And after that discussion, you know, the council may make some decisions based on what they hear to take some further steps. Now, in the Snyderville Basin, the vast, there's what I think about 5 water companies out in the basin right now. I think on the east side of Summit County, there are as many as 40 water, public water systems. And then on top of that, you add another 20 to 25 seasonal systems. What we want to make sure is that the people who are involved and operate and are part of those systems have an opportunity to be, you know, present when we make what will be probably some very important decisions here in the upcoming months.
So you're telling me that these restrictions would be for all of Summit County, not just, say, Mountain Regional customers or Snyderville Basin customers?
It could be. I want to make sure that I'm clear that I'm not suggesting they're going to be just west side oriented or countywide. That's what I think we need to be able to at least initially discuss on this. And, you know, people have asked me since this topic has come up, you know, does Summit County, does the council have the ability to tell, you know, a private water company what they can and what they can't do? That answer probably precisely answered by one of our attorneys. But my understanding is, under an emergency order, Summit County Council, would have the authority to place restrictions on these public and private systems. That hasn't happened. There hasn't been a decision to make that step. Before we make that step, we want to make sure that we have the right people part of the dialogue as early as possible, and that's what we're going to be shooting for, is that initial discussion with the council. Won't be next week, but hopefully in the next couple of weeks, when we can find a slot on the agenda, we're going to be coming forward with that discussion.
So what are the current water restrictions? I mean, I guess they just vary from water company to water company.
They do. I was having a conversation with Scott Morrison as recent as yesterday afternoon. In the Mountain regional system, I believe that they are going with every other day watering restrictions. They're asking water users to go down to 2 times a week. I know that'll be part of our conversation with we're in front of the council. I'm not exactly sure what the other basin systems are doing, such as Service Area 3 in the Silver Creek area, or Summit Water. You know, we've got Gorgoza. There's High Valley in the Highland Estates area. I'm not exactly sure what level they're at right now, but I think they're all probably beginning at this point, or if not already, put some initial reduction phases and some plans into place.
So I guess the only way to, if you were to go to just twice a week, I mean, there's no way to go, oh, this guy's an odd address and measuring on a, and watering on a an even day. I mean, there's just no way to see that anymore. I guess it's, we're just going to know who's watering based on the color of their lawn?
Well, I know that Mountain Regional has the ability to monitor meter to meter, I believe, on water usage. Yeah, certainly the drive-by enforcement, where we're seeing just incredibly Irish Midwestern green lawns, might be a tip, but I think there are some systems out there that may have a better way of tracking. I think this is a bigger problem than just sheer enforcement strategies alone. That's important. I think what we need to be able to do is to have a very clear understanding as part of a broader community, the situation that we're in. Nobody wants to be, you know, driving around being punitive and being water police. Long before we get to that point, I think we want to make sure everybody kind of grasps the severity of the situation that we're in. And, you know, my thinking is that if, you know, we can come together to address the community battle with COVID-19, I think we can come together and battle this next challenge ahead of us, and that being the drought we're in. And so making sure everybody's aware of it, making sure that we can convince everybody and get them to embrace why we're asking them to do what we're going to potentially ask them to do. I got big faith in this community. I think people will step up.
All right. And so when you talk about these more robust potential for more robust restrictions, I mean, in perhaps landscaping updates, let's talk a little bit about that, because it's like we've got a lot of homeowner associations that require a certain standard of landscaping. Would county ordinance take precedent over whatever the homeowner association had to say about that?
Yeah, boy, you nailed it on the head. That's why it's so important to have them as part of our discussions. The county has the ability and has the regulatory authority to enforce their rules and regulations rather than get in the crosshairs or crosswise with the HOAs. We would like to enlist their support and rethinking what their requirements for landscaping and irrigation are, because it's you know, hopefully it's going to be for everyone's benefit, because what we don't want to see here is the community in a situation where, in the event that we have a catastrophic condition, a wildfire in some of our neighborhoods, that there isn't sufficient water to fight those. And once again, we are in conversations with many of these HOAs on a regular basis. They're good people. They understand. They certainly understand the need for community safety. And I have to believe that in a balance between community aesthetics and community safety, we're going to be able to work with them to find the appropriate balance.
And what are the regulations regarding like artificial turf in Summit County? I know of someone in Park City who had a really tough time getting just a very small patch of this turf installed.
I can't speak for the current regulations inside Park City, but the Summit County Code certainly is oriented towards a low water use, high desert plant environment. The key is to reduce water. If someone came in, I believe, and as part of their development plan, a component being some sort of artificial turf surface, I don't think that we have regulations that would prohibit that. And frankly, you know, we would probably take a look at that as part of that plan and see if potentially it's going to be a model for, you know, for future solutions. Am I saying that we're just going to have green, you know, AstroTurf, sport turf lawns all over the basin? No, that's not what I'm saying. But, you know, if people are looking for, as part of an overall comprehensive landscape strategy for their property, you know, they want that green, you know, maybe a patch in the backyard or, you know, an accent of that in the front yard. I think that's something that we should be looking at. I think what we're trying to come to grips with is the traditional Bermuda grass, large turf, spender, you know, weekends mowing the lawn. We need to make a conscious decision. Is that where we want to put our water resources towards or not? One more time, county's not stepping in and saying you can't have grass right now. But what we are intending to do is to begin that discussion, and hopefully it won't be a long and prolonged discussion that prevents us from, you know, putting some steps in place to help with our water crisis. But we want to have the discussion first, and that's what we're intending to do in the next couple of weeks.
All right. Well, and then certainly people are asking, rather than turning off the water, why not turn off the growth? If there's not enough water, why do we keep approving everything?
That's a bigger question than I think we can answer here in the next couple minutes. I respect that question. It's a valid question, and it's a valid concern. And I'm pretty confident we'll have more opportunities to discuss that publicly as we move forward.
Okay, so at this point, there are no proposed restrictions that anybody can see. There is no proposed temporary zoning ordinance on new development. Right now, it's just a heads up that pay attention, that it's going to be a discussion that's happening here in the next couple of weeks.
Correct. No temporary zoning ordinance language drafted sitting on my desk. I would, however, encourage everyone, every resident, in the earshot of my voice to reach out to their water provider and understand what that particular water provider's position restrictions are on watering. Would also ask people to please take this serious, and if there is a way they can dial back their water usage, particularly in the outside irrigation aspect of things, that they would please consider doing so.
All right. Summit County Community Development Director Pat Putt, thanks for your time this morning.
Thanks, Leslie.
The Utah chapter of the Alzheimer's Association hosting a virtual panel today for those caring for their loved ones with dementia. On the phone, I have the regional manager of Utah's chapter for the Alzheimer's Association, Amanda Charles. And in the studio with me, I have Summit County residents Glenn and Tracy Seymour, who are caring for Glenn's mother with dementia. Good morning to everybody.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
Amanda, let's start with you and just get the details then of the virtual panel.
Yes, thank you. So the panel, like you said, is tonight, June 22nd. It'll go from 7 to 8 p.m. and it'll be available through Zoom. So the best way to access that is to email me at aecharles@alz.org. But ultimately, the panel is an opportunity for caregivers in the area to learn about what resources are available for them and to get some tips and tricks from field professionals.
Yeah, so when we're talking about caregivers, we're talking about people like Glenn and Tracy, or are we talking about professionals?
No, we are talking about people like Glenn and Tracy, people that are caring for their loved one with Alzheimer's or dementia and aren't quite sure how to navigate that situation yet.
All right. So who do you have on the panel here?
So we have four panelists available tonight. The first is Laura Wall, who's the development director for the Alzheimer's Association Utah chapter. We also have Ellen Silver, who is the executive director of Jewish Family Services here in Summit County. We have Kate Nedorostek, who is a manager for the Utah Caregiver Support Program. And we have local Cheryl Bagshaw, who's a dementia practitioner and educator. And so they will all be presenting on various subjects related to caregivers, and then they will do a brief Q&A at the end of the session.
All right, so are people able then to submit questions in advance, or they'll be able to do it through the Zoom app, or?
Yeah, so we will have people submit questions through the chat function on Zoom during the presentation, and then we will take care of those questions at the end.
All right. Well, let's bring Glenn and Tracy into it. Glenn, maybe start with you since it's your mom. Can you kind of just kind of give us an overview of the situation that you're dealing with?
Yeah, so my mother was diagnosed with Alzheimer's back in 2015, and it was really something we noticed. She wasn't living with us at the time. She was living in Arizona. And we noticed some changes when we went on a family vacation. And so we asked that she get looked at by her doctor and then moved on to a neurologist to diagnose, and then ended up diagnosing Alzheimer's. And it really was, because she was living afar, it was really our friends, family friends, who started telling us about things that they were noticing different about her. And so we became a lot more involved in her care and what we were going to do with her, and finally insisted that she needed to first move out of her house and into an apartment because she was living by herself in a large house. And then finally, after a couple months of that, we really found that wasn't working because of the long distance and trying to travel to her and asking friends to take care of her. She could no longer drive anymore. And so we moved her to be near us. And it's a progression. So it's been going on for over 5 years now, and just watching the progression, and what we've learned is it takes a lot of help to get through this.
So is she living with you, or is she in a facility?
She's in a facility. At the time we had two kids living at home. And it just, we didn't think it would work out to have her in the house also. And so we felt that the care that she needed As well, she does like a little bit of an independence and a different, different times, the time that she's up and stuff is different than our family. We just felt like a facility would be best for her.
Yeah, and I guess at the point at that time too, were you both working? That you actually had jobs. It couldn't have worked at home. I'm guessing.
I was transitioning. Around that time, shortly after she was diagnosed and we moved her, I decided to retire, and so I retired early, and that really actually ended up being a blessing because trying to take care of her. Liquidating a lot of her, the downsizing that you got to go through, and there's a tremendous amount of work, especially as you initially take over the caregiving of your family member, of your mother, in my case, my mother, is a tremendous amount of work. And certainly the resources that are out there help a lot. But, you think about financial, medical, her day-to-day, moving her, it's a tremendous burden, and you need the help.
Well, as two parents with Alzheimer's, there's that side, and then there's the emotional side. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that, Tracy, just because stepping aside, it's not your mom, but it's still very emotional.
It is. You have to tell yourself that the disease is making her act the way she is. You have to tell yourself that over and over and over again. And with our kids, it was kind of hard for them to understand, hey, grandma's acting really weird. And, it doesn't even matter how old they are. You just have to explain. She can't help a lot of the things she's doing. And, you have to have a good sense of humor. You just have to laugh at things, otherwise you would just cry.
Yeah, and it's like every new conversation is a new conversation, even though you've had the conversation just 2 minutes ago.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess that's really kind of one of the things that maybe you could talk about, Glenn, too, just what you learn about living in the present.
Yeah, you do have to learn patience because you do have those, as you say, you do have those conversations today that you had yesterday. The sense of time is gone. So, for example, everything that she tells you happened today, or earlier today, or it happened yesterday, regardless of when it happened. She can be bringing up something that was 2-3 months ago, and it just happened today. And you have to have that patience because and I have to constantly tell myself to watch what I say because you don't want to upset her. Or correct her, but at the same time, you want to be polite and maintain that relationship.
Yeah. So, in terms of the caregiving, you've got somebody caring for her.
Yeah.
But what is it? You still feel like there's a lot of weight on you.
Yeah. Certainly the transition was probably the bigger weight. We take her out. We take her out for walks and exercise. I take her to the opera and to the symphony. Obviously, for the last year, that's been kind of on hold. And this last year has been very tough because, we went almost 14 months without seeing her. And that's very difficult. So, our communication was telephone and some emails. We feel an obligation to see her every week or, twice a week to take her out, to give her some activities because otherwise, she can have a very sedentary lifestyle without stimulation that, we feel is important.
So have you used the association then, Tracy, to get some help? And
yes, when she was first diagnosed, I did a lot of research to see what we were up against. We actually ended up starting an Alzheimer's support group. We moved here from Omaha, so we started one at our church with the Alzheimer's Association. We became involved in the walk. We're involved in the walk here. There are a lot of good resources from the Alzheimer's Association, and their education programs are just wonderful, and they really help you. And then they also help you as a caregiver to take care of yourself too. You don't feel guilty because you're, maybe you back off a little and say, okay, we've got someone helping her. We can maybe go away for a week and not feel guilty. But the Alzheimer's Association has just been wonderful with the help that they have given us.
Yeah. And there are a lot of other, I mean, they do a good job. There's other places where you can get help too that we've tapped into, for example, in helping downsize in your house and figuring out how to do the moves and setting up financial powers of attorney and health medical powers of attorney. There's other resources besides just the Alzheimer's Association who are very important to be able to tap into.
All right. And Amanda, back to you. I mean, can you tell us? I know that the association puts a lot of money into kind of the research of this. Are there any new updates on causes, cures, anything like that?
Yes, actually. I have a very exciting update about that. So just a week or two ago, the FDA passed aducanumab, which is a new drug, which is now going to be going by the generic name Aduhelm. And that is the first drug that actually attacks Alzheimer's disease itself. So it attacks the plaques and tangles that are specifically the amyloid plaques that build up in the brain that cause Alzheimer's disease. So up until this point, we've had medications that kind of mitigated Alzheimer's symptoms, but this is the first actual drug that we have that can attack the disease itself. So it's a very exciting time in the community. It really gives people a lot of hope. You know, we haven't seen any kind of a major breakthrough for over 15 years. And so for the FDA to announce that decision, it was a big moment for a lot of people that now have some hope for their loved ones and for the future.
Okay. Anything else you want to tell us? Again, that panel is 7 to 8 p.m. Maybe the email again if people wanted to participate in the Zoom here.
Yeah, absolutely. One thing that I just wanted to add on with that is that in reference to what Glenn said about all of these different resources that are also beneficial, that's really the point of the panel, is that we have Alzheimer's Association resources that we want everyone to know about, but there are also wonderful people in the community like Ellen Silver with the Jewish Family Services that have resources that are available to caregivers. And so part of this presentation is to help us highlight those resources as well. So anyone who wants to join the caregiver panel tonight from 7 to 8 can do so by emailing me, Amanda Charles, at aecharles@alz.org. And I can send you all of the information for that.
Okay. All right, Amanda, Glenn, and Tracy, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Park City History Museum has a new leader at the helm. KPCW's Jessica Lowell reporting that the museum announced a Virginian, Morgan Pierce, as its new executive director.
After a nationwide search, Morgan Pierce will begin as executive director of the Park City History Museum July 15th. That's according to a press release from the museum. The previous director, Sandra Morrison, stepped down from her role almost a year ago. In his new position, Pierce will work with the museum's board of trustees to finalize and execute their strategic plan while working with the community's nonprofits. Pierce is moving to Park City from Culpeper, Virginia, where he's the executive director of the town's History Museum. His previous experience includes serving as the chief curator at Harriman Grima and Gallier Historic Houses in New Orleans, Louisiana, and working as curator of collections at the Museum of the Shenandoah Valley in Winchester, Virginia. Paige Anderson is the chair of the Board of Trustees for the Park City History Museum. She says the board was drawn to Pierce because of his extensive experience in the history field. She adds he'll create pieces with lasting success by building up audiences and community engagement. Pierce has a BA in history from James Madison University and an MA in arts management from George Mason University. He's moving to Utah with his wife and two children and looks forward to recreating outdoors. Jessica Lowell, KPCW News.
Well, Olympic skier Libby Ludlow and her award-winning illustrator Nathan Jarvis are launching their second children's book, Goodnight, Charlotte. Libby joins us now on the phone. Nathan is in studio. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Hello.
Hi, Libby. Libby, let's start with you. For those who have read to their kids, they're very likely familiar with the classic Goodnight Moon, having to say goodnight to everything before the kid goes to bed. So is this kind of a takeoff on that?
Yeah, it's similar. It's basically starting with an epic day on the ski hill and then saying goodnight and goodbye to a handful of things on the ski hill, because everything goes to sleep at night except one thing, which are the snowcats. They come awake and do their work.
Okay. So you are launching a Kickstarter campaign. I guess this worked pretty well for your first book, AB Skis.
Yeah, that's right. So AB Skis is a really successful book for kids, alphabet book about the magical world of skiing and Kickstarter. We fully funded that project a couple years ago in less than 24 hours. And so we're taking the same approach for Goodnight Chairlift and hoping we can fund our first print order of Goodnight Chairlift and bring it to our backers before anyone else can get their hands on it.
All right, so tell me how this Kickstarter campaign works.
Yeah, so it just launched this morning and basically pre-order the book at a discount. And after the Kickstarter closes in 30 days, we'll make our overseas print order and our backers will receive the book if everything is on schedule before the holidays. So it's a really perfect gift for little skiers and snowboarders, and our Kickstarter backers will be the first to receive them, hopefully in time for the holidays.
Yeah, how much would you do you have to raise before you publish?
Our minimum is $7,500.
Okay. And so is it already written and illustrated? I guess I'll turn to it, but is it already written on your half?
Yeah, the manuscript is all done. It's a super playful, fun manuscript, and Nathan is well on his way to completing the illustrations. He's already done a handful, and he's working away, and he'll be finishing in time for us to make that print order. So it's kind of in progress, and we're waiting for some wonderful people to make their pre-order so we can fund the project.
Okay, so what do people need to do then? Just search Kickstarter for...
Yeah, if you just Google Kickstarter Goodnight Chairlift, you'll get to the right spot. I'll make sure that you guys have the link as well so you can link to it directly from KPCW.
Okay. And then, Nathan, so how many, she says a handful of illustrations, how many do you need?
Well, it's a 32-page book, you know, picture book for children. And so it's a total of 32 pages worth of art and design. There's a grundle of art, whatever a grundle is. There's a lot of fun spreads for the kids to explore. Libby is extremely talented in capturing the soul and the spirit of the ski culture and the mountain culture. And so I get to have fun interpreting that with what I do, which is to create fun visuals for kids to play with and to discover things. So much like AB Skis, I have a lot of images also hidden in the illustrations for kids to be searching for. So it's interactive rather than just I'm a couch potato being read to kind of book.
Yeah. It's your illustrations are very recognizable. I mean, are they, is it just... Is it pen? Is it ink? Is it paint?
It's digital airbrush. And so, you know, I was a traditional airbrush artist for many years. And then once the technology caught up, I shifted to digital. So, you know, my work has been around for a long time, Children's Television Network and Highlights for Children and every major book publisher in the country and overseas. And so my work tends to look very familiar to a lot of people. It's especially oriented towards children. And so for what Libby and I have been doing with this, creating a wonderful bridge for kids who like to ski and like to snowboard and for their parents who would like to do the same. It's just a way for them to get excited and involved when they're not on the snow so that when they do get to the snow, they're in a playful mood.
So you know what the book says, so you can work ahead here. So in terms of how long does it take you to finish a page?
It's entirely up to the page. So this is sort of like asking how long does it take to go down a ski run. In some instances, it's really fast. In some instances, the same run might take a really long time, depending on circumstances. And so, you know, once again, Libby's words are magnificent. And sometimes I will read them, and I'll instantly know where I want to go with it. And sometimes I'll read them and I'll think, I need to think about this one for a little while. And so the role of an illustrator is not just to visually copy what the writer has written, but to reinterpret it so that it adds to it. So you get both the big bang of the words and the big bang of the pictures.
Okay. And maybe you can talk a little bit about how you and Libby kind of partnered up here.
Well, Libby and I met several years ago. She was a student of mine in a course I was teaching at the Kimball Art Center. And, a little while after that, she reached out to me with this idea about AB skis. And I was instantly excited. You know, I'm a ski instructor and children's specialist and trainer at Park City. And so when she said she wanted to do a book for kids to help them, get anchored in the ski world, I just was all over it. So we've been working together since AB Skis. And AB Skis was just a marvelous, marvelous success. And, you know, and so we're back again. And so when Libby said she had another book idea, I just was, you know, excited and thought, good, let's do it. You know, let's get the stoke going for all the families and the kids. And yeah. She's fun to work with. She's brilliant.
So you're both skiers. What about snowboarders? Are they part of the book, Libby?
They are. So Nathan's incorporating snowboarders in the illustrations, and all of the language is actually sport neutral. So it's really all about the mountain culture and having fun on the hill and then really appealing to young kids with that fun imagery and language.
All right. And the AB Skis book, very successful. Tell me about some of the awards that you've received.
Yeah, so we received 4 book awards in 2020 and have sold over 5,000 copies. You can see over 80 five-star reviews on Amazon. So it's been, for a self-published book, a tremendous success. Continues to sell really well. And, you know, the best part is hearing from families how much they love reading it. And even little kids are bringing them uphill when they're experiencing skiing on the hill, repeating some of the rhymes that they learned in AB Skis. And it's just, been a huge joy to watch that project come to life and just enhance people's nighttime story reading and time on the hill.
Okay. All right. Anything else you guys want to tell us?
I just want to toss in that we've also included adaptive skiing and ski and snow sports within this publication. So we've been doing that within PSIA, AASI, to make certain that everyone knows that regardless of who they are or where they're coming from, that the mountains are a playground and that there's fun for everyone. So in the new Goodnight Chairlift, we have both the skiers and the riders and adaptive elements. So it really is it's an outreach to everyone on the earth who wants to go turn the mountain into a playground.
All right. Libby, anything else you want to add?
No, I just appreciate the support of Park City. It's such a wonderful community, and it means a lot to get Park City residents behind this project to make sure we can bring it to print. So thank you.
Okay. Libby, Nathan, thanks so much.
Thank you.
For pets, summer fun carries some serious risks along with all of the good times. KPCW's Michelle Deininger has more on the most common warm weather threats to pets.
Hot Utah summers hold particular risks for pets. Just as humans have to adjust to living and exercising at elevation, pets also need care and caution exercised on their behalf to keep them safe in summer heat. Most people know not to leave dogs unattended in hot cars with the windows up. Windows that are open a few inches won't cool car interiors nearly enough, and fully open windows present other risks such as property or pet theft and an increased risk of pets jumping out. Newcomers take note, Park City has a 1-minute limit on idling in order to safeguard air quality. So unless you have an electric car with an AC mode, leaving cars running is not an option either. Outdoor life on Utah trails may be wonderful, but also carries risks. Chief among those is potential for heat stroke and burning paws in pets. Travis Eaglin, a vet technician at the White Pine Veterinary Clinic, explained what to watch for.
They start really slowing behind. They're wobbly, seeming disoriented. They're panting really heavily, and then you can start seeing their eyes get really red. Those are signs that their body level's getting too hot. You need to get immediate attention. Once their internal body limit starts hitting above 104 degrees, that's when you start seeing damage to the organs.
If a pet exhibits any of those signs during an expedition, pick it up and carry it the rest of the way. Get it water, and if symptoms don't go away within a few minutes, seek medical attention immediately. Avoiding heat stroke in pets is easy. Don't take them on strenuous treks in the hottest part of the day. Remember that shorter-legged animals can't go as far as long-legged breeds. Always carry a collapsible water container and sufficient water for both you and your pets. A couple of sips from your water bottle won't cut it. And know that packed dirt trails, not just asphalt, can get too hot for paws. To test whether surfaces are safe for your pet, put your hand flat on the ground. If it's uncomfortable for your hand, your pet shouldn't walk on it. Finally, outdoor-loving dogs need to be checked for ticks, which are becoming increasingly common in the West. Though Lyme disease is not yet a concern in Utah, some ticks here carry Rocky Mountain spotted fever, which can also be deadly for humans and dogs if not treated with antibiotics. After 5 years with no cases of Rocky Mountain spotted fever anywhere in the area, Eaglin said White Pine has seen 2 cases this year, and other clinics likely have as well.
Some of it could be the warmer temperatures is what we've kind of heard, and they're just migrating up into this area, and all it takes is just a brush up, and it could be when you're on a trail, they will go to take a blood meal, and then that's how they latch on, and they'll stay on until they're done, and then they'll fall off. They are on brush, they're on shrubs, on trees, tend to be on a lot of the trails, and you're just walking, you know, along with your pet, and just brush up against it, and then it's on. It can get on your clothing, your backpack, inside your shoes.
Eaglin said if pet owners find ticks embedded in animal skin, the safest move is to bring them in to have the tick removed by a professional. People can do it themselves at home, but it's tricky, and oftentimes ticks' heads stay stuck in pet skin when owners remove them with tweezers. If a tick's head remains in a pet's body, that can cause infection, and diseases can still be transmitted. If ticks are not embedded into pet skin, but just walking around on them, owners can easily remove them. Eaglin said White Pine would like clients to photograph ticks they find and email them to the office so they're aware of what ticks are in the area. A safe way to do that is to put the tick into a clear plastic bag to photograph it before disposing of it. People are not being asked right now to bring ticks into health officials or vet offices. Owners need to be vigilant about checking pets, and for pets with longer coats, using their fingers to thoroughly comb through pet fur daily. But don't panic. Many ticks do not carry dangerous diseases, and their bites won't harm pets. Ticks can't transmit disease until they've been embedded into animal skin and drawing blood from them for about 12 hours. And even the most serious tick-borne diseases are fully treatable with antibiotics. Rocky Mountain spotted fever symptoms in pets include decreased appetite, swelling in face or legs, pain, and extreme sensitivity. For example, a dog overreacting to any physical activity or contact. Dogs might also vomit, have diarrhea, or be very wobbly when moving around. Pets are vulnerable, so it's safe to err on the side of caution and call your vet with any concerns. Michelle Dininger, KPCW News.